Okay, if I could have your attention, please. This is BioSci 101, December 10th, 2008. It looks like we have a pretty good crowd today, so I'm not going to worry about you too much. At least one administrative announcement about all your papers that are stacked outside my door. First of all, you can show up anytime you want to, either at my office or anywhere, and show me your portfolio if it's full. I think Chris and I both have a little spreadsheet that shows the Sheldon papers that have already been graded. And if they've already been graded, that means I've probably made some marks on them and they're probably at home. Although there are a few of them, or actually a stack about that high, that I put out in those boxes this morning. I will try very hard to get everything that you have given to me, all your writings, back to you by Monday, so that you'll have all of finals week to pick up anything you want to out of there. Those of you who are showing me your portfolios and have not, and I have not graded your Sheldon writing, then I'm trying to go ahead and grade it right then when I do it. So that means that whatever paper goes back into the box will not have any marks on it, because I'll put the marks on whatever I read in your portfolios. Y'all have done a truly wonderful job on those Sheldon papers. I mean, they really, really are good, and especially all of those who took the advice or to actually answer the questions you were asked and did it in a very obvious way. The vast majority of you did that real well. I feel a little bit of an obligation, well, actually feel a lot of an obligation to go through those papers and read them. I tend to read them fairly quickly and pick out sentences fairly quickly and mark some of those things. So it may not seem like, you know, there are a whole lot of feedback on there, but I've looked at a lot of it. Anybody else have any questions at all? Okay, today I'm going to talk about infectivity as one of the big ideas. All right. The movement of infective agents through populations. All right. The fact that we ended up talking about biology means one of those days means that I'm going to skip one of those, and I think that I'm going to skip this one, and then on Friday come back and talk about the concept of an emergent property, because one of the textbooks we used one year really dwelt on that early on and in the first chapter, and I thought it was a kind of a remarkable bit of thinking to present, particularly in introductory courses. So I believe that on Friday, if I can find all that old material, I will come back and deal with life as an emergent property and what emergent properties are in general. So infection and symbiosis. Symbiosis means living together in some kind of an intimate physiological or biochemical way. So if you're one of those people who have a tapeworm in your gut right now, then that tapeworm is intimately associated with you. It's a different species than you are, but you and that tapeworm are sharing molecules, and that molecule and that tapeworm is taking up molecules in a very specific sort of biochemical relationship with you. I'm going to start this by asking a very simple little question, and that is, what is a fish? Now, this one happens to be Lipomus cyanalis, or pardon me, Lipomus macrocharis, the bluegill sunfish. And there are many of you, one way you can tell a bluegill from other kinds of fish, and next time you catch one, many of you in this class, I know, have actually caught these fish, if not outright eaten them. So the next time you catch something that you think is as bluegill. First of all, you look at the mouth, and it's fairly small. The edge of the mouth really doesn't go back very far behind the eye. And if you catch it and you have it in your hand, just grab this fin and push it forward. And if this tip reaches the eye, then there's a good chance. And you caught it in Nebraska. There's a good chance it's actually a bluegill. Lipomus macrocyrus is exposed to something else. Most people tend to think of a fish like this, a wild fish, as existing out in a pond someplace. This is a place we work out in western Nebraska quite a bit called Dunwoody Pond, and it's full of bluegills like this. But what really is this animal? What is this animal? And the only reason I give you this list right here of all of the parasites reported in the scientific literature from the years 1973 to 77 is that I have this whole library full of books that I got free from the United States government that list, called the Index Catalog of Veterinary Medicine, and it lists really all of the parasites. You can find it very quickly in those books, and they're set apart in volumes. So I just happened, when I got ready to make this slide, pulled out one of them, and it happened to be the one from 1973 to 77. And these are all worms of various kinds. Some of them are thorny-headed worms that stick a really spiny proboscis in their gut wall. Some of them are worms that live on the gills, like some of these. There are some leeches down here, a couple of them. Some of them live in the tissues and grow up as adults when that fish gets eaten by something like a heron. So this animal that you're thinking of as a fish is really a community of other organisms. It's really a community of other organisms, a lot of them, in fact. Oops, where was I? I hit the wrong button. So this leads us to the next question, what is a mouse? And of course, this one happens to be an extraordinarily common Nebraska animal, Paramiscus maniculatus. And its tail in nature is a little bit longer than the one that's in that food web picture in your book. But the one that's actually in your book is probably intended to be this. Because if you look at that picture in your book, what you're going to see is not only the big beautiful eyes and the great big ears, all of those bodily features that make this a cute mouse instead of an ugly, frightening mouse, and this little white paws, and they're really nice. And the tail also is sort of sharply bicolored there. It has a sharp line between the brown and the white below. Most of us think of these mice as living out in the brush someplace, and that's a view from the hills at Cedar Point. So you know from looking at the fish exactly where this next slide is headed. And this is also from one of those books, and again, this is the one right next to it, from the late 70s, that single year. This list, it turns out, is only the arthropods. This doesn't include any of the worms or any of the protists that live inside these mice. These are only the ticks and the fleas and the lice that live on this species of mouse. So again, when a biologist looks at every living organism, that biologist really sees this community of other organisms that live in and on them. Quite frankly, the world's biota, the world's animals, I should say, look something like this in terms of representation. The vast majority of them are beetles, the color-coded yellow. And actually, if this is all of the world's beetles, or all of the world's known species of animals, approximately a third of all those are actually species of beetles. And what I put in there in that species of beetles are some of the little parasites that live inside beetles at the rate of about two different species per species of beetles. So there are something like 300,000 species of beetles that we know about and living inside of them among one group of single-celled parasites. There are probably another 500,000 species of these things. So all of these different animal groups really contain their fauna, and that's not even to mention, they're viruses and they're bacteria. And so if you add those, and they're fungi, so if you add those, then you get lots and lots and lots. So that every species that we've actually studied has been shown to be the home for many, many, many other kinds of species. So living in and on an animal that's much larger than you are is the most common way of life on Earth. And for those of you that know your English literature, then you know, or you may have seen this quote from Jonathan Swift. And so naturalists observe a flea and has smaller fleas that on him prey, and these have still smaller still to bite them, and so proceed at infinitum. Big fleas have little fleas. What you really don't often see is the next two lines of that poetry, and it tells you immediately that Jonathan Swift, the sarcastic cynic, is really talking about his fellow poets, whereas the biologists take those first four lines and tend to talk about parasitism and infectious agents. As a general rule, in groups such as those in this auditorium, the most familiar animal is this one right here. And everything else that we've just talked about before, all of the rest of the world's biota, really occupies a very narrow wedge of our awareness. And one of my jobs, and one of the jobs of every biology instructor, is to try to make that a little bit broader. But everything we saw before is just jammed right in there. So this is really my perception of our perception of the universe. We know a lot about ourselves, we think. We're sort of familiar with our pets and the food and fiber animals and the stuff we hunt, but everything else is sort of relegated to this little place in our consciousness. The question of your time, however, is what is a human being? And if there's anything that science, population, environmental change, molecular biology, anything that all of the world's, the information technology that you all live with, if it's doing anything, it's making the answer to that question more and more and more complex as the day goes by. And that, in essence, is the leading issue of your time. It's the leading question of your time. What is a human being? And of course, you can define that in a great many ways, and people define it in all kinds of ways every single solitary day. And I just picked out a few of those from emails I get from my friends on the web. Here, incidentally, is a picture out of a freshman textbook we used not too long ago. This is an Auguste Rodin's The Kiss, probably the second or third most famous sculpture in the entire world. And what these textbook authors did, Tobin and Dushik, in this book called Asking About Life, they took this picture and enlisted all of these are all fungi and bacteria that are parasitic in various parts of the body. And I thought this was really inspired. It's one of the most instructional pictures that I've ever seen in a freshman textbook. I mean, it really, really is. And that picture alone, back when I taught 103, which used to be called 204, led really to one of the most interesting lab exercises we'd ever done, in a freshman course. And that is to ask, what happens if you just take one of those little auger plates like that, lift up the lid, put your four fingers on it, close the lid, turn it upside down. Assuming that you haven't been poking around in any of your bodily orifices before you did that. And what happens is, in a class like this, you get the most staggering array of microorganisms that grow out on that plate. Those are mine, but good grief, you can't believe what grows out of students. And just like future potential for good or evil, that you can't tell by looking at somebody's outer surface. You can't tell what's going to grow up on those plates by looking at that individual. Some of them think that they are absolutely, totally spotless, and in 4 days there is this veritable forest coming out. Others you would immediately assume are walking examples of filth, and nothing happens. So you can't tell. But the one thing you can tell is that not only most of you, but everybody on this campus, everybody in this town, everybody in this country, everybody in this world is covered with this stuff. And these are only the bacteria. So when it comes time to write a textbook, like a parasitology textbook, the question is, how do you actually communicate this idea that we are living communities to a group of college students? And so I couldn't get permission. This is out of our parasitology textbook. I couldn't get permission to actually use that Rodin figure, and the one I wanted to get, I thought it was kind of copycat, and it cost money and all this stuff. So we have an artist, a guy named Bill Ober, who draws these pictures. And so I said, Bill, draw me a couple of college students on their way to a prom somewhere and dress them up, and we're going to infect them with things. And so he drew these pictures, and so we infected them with really common parasites that you'd find around the world. Head lice, body lice, malaria, tapeworms, trichomoniasis, fleas, Congo floor maggots, chigger bites, whipworm, you name it. Okay? This is how you go about it. For those of you who are concerned about this, this whole phenomenon of disease, I'll also then pick a line out of Lewis Thomas, who you should be familiar with by now, talking about symbiosis, the most common way of life on Earth in general, relative to disease. And it turns out that this is really the disease caused by infectious agents is really a relatively rare circumstance compared to the number of different kinds of agents and other organisms that live in and on other people. Very quickly, I'd like to, before I get to cultural transmission, which is actually the album cover issue, before I get to that, I'd like to very quickly talk about the economics of disease and the cultural costs of disease and symbiosis. And here are some parasites called Cryptosporidium, or Cryptosporidium parvum is really the one. All of this is a slice through somebody's intestine, and all these little black dots on the surface. This is what the lining of your intestine looks like, the cells. And these are all the parasites, and here they are in electron microscope. It turns out that back in the early 90s, there was this leak in the water filtration system in Milwaukee. And about a third or a fourth of the people in that city got infected with Cryptosporidium. Well, what happens, and some of you, I suspect, have been, especially if you've hung around cattle very much, have actually been infected with crypto. And if your immune system is in pretty good shape, then you probably had severe diarrhea for a few days and got over it. Well, in Milwaukee back in 1990, and you can, when I put this stuff up on Blackboard, you'll be able to find all these references in the literature, in the primary literature, 400,000 cases. And because this happened in the 90s, and because it happened in the United States of America, then this is probably the most, the one outbreak of infectious disease in this country that was the most heavily studied in terms of its economic impact. And so we have mild cases, we have moderate cases, we have severe cases. Most of the severe cases are either in immunocompromised people taking immunosuppressive drugs for transplants or some reason or other, old people in their 70s and 80s, infirm folks. And so these are really, there's kind of a minority of those cases. The vast majority of all those cases, 350,000 of them, were relatively mild. And that's, you know, people tend to get over it. They have severe diarrhea for a few days and then it goes away. Here are some interesting numbers, ladies and gentlemen. For example, the medical costs of 350,000 mild cases, about $800,000 overall. The productivity loss, however, is about $40 million. And this comes about as a result of doctors and lawyers and dentists and business executives who are now in Washington asking for bailouts. All of these people, when you calculate the value of their time lost and the value of what they might be paying in terms of taxes and producing for society, then the productivity loss is many times that of the medical loss. And even in the case of moderate infections, which is probably requiring some prescription drugs to fight diarrhea and probably more out of work for more than 2 weeks, this is still, it's the productivity loss that's really the bad one. And the overall loss then to really severe cryptosporidiosis is less than these total losses appear to productivity. This is a big time take-home lesson that chronic illness of all kinds has a major negative impact on societies because of the loss of productivity as much as anything and the loss of human resources to do stuff. So we might then ask, what's the cultural cost, which is part of the productivity cost, of this segment of disease in this segment of humanity? I'll remind you that you're about here on this time scale. Your life expectancy is going to be right up about here. In fact, that's going to be about my age up here, and so you're going to have about another 10 years after that in terms of life expectancy. And so this situation and this situation are ones that you will be dealing with if you stay healthy as long as I am, which my mother would never have predicted. There is a gentleman named Richard Garrant who's at the University of Virginia Medical School, and this chart really comes from one of his publications in which he actually analyzed the causes of death in children, several million children, less than 5 years old in developing countries. And it turns out that malaria is important, of course, measles and acute respiratory infection are, but diarrhea is, you know, responsible for about a fourth of those deaths and responsible for massive amounts of illness. What happens when your kid is sick? What happens when your toddler, less than 2 years old, is sick, has diarrhea? Do you cuddle and love that child? Do you sing the family songs? Do you read the little books? Does this person pay attention to you? What happens when your child is constantly sick? And the answer is, in those very formative years, that child does not get the parenting simply because of the illness, does not get the parenting that a healthy child would get. So what Garrant did was run a whole bunch, do a long-term study in northern Brazil and some of these rural communities in which there's extensive childhood diarrhea, and ran a bunch of psychological tests on it. You all may not know this, but you've probably taken some of these yourselves in the public schools, and asked what happens to their test scores, which are supposed to measure their mental function, at the age of 6 to 9 if they had certain kinds of childhood diarrhea before the age of 2, and engage this whole community in actually participating in this study. And although we're not statisticians, and I don't have another semester to really go through these numbers, because they're all below 0.05, tell you that early childhood illness has a major negative impact on the later ability of that child to carry out cognitive functions, reading, writing, interpreting art. The other information that Garant talks about is the so-called fertility rate. And one of the things that global data tell you that's sort of counterintuitive is that in those areas with the highest infant mortality, the total fertility rate tends to also be the highest. So New York City around 1900 was right up to about where Uganda was in the middle 90s. Right now the United States is down here low, and most of this drop in this country is due to economic development, adequate sewage, window screens, education, and economic and educational empowerment. This is exactly the opposite of what Malthus would have predicted. So to follow up here are some very interesting quotes. The national interest is ever more intimately associated with the process of development. And you can pick this up. This is Thomas Weller was a Nobel Prize winner from Harvard. This is Richard Garant, the guy who did all this research. We may now see the dawning of an era when perhaps for the first time in human evolution, we can begin to see the survival advantage of caring about other people, the poor in the tropics. And Thomas Jefferson, however, goes really back to education. I know of no safe depository, the ultimate powers, but in the people themselves. And if we think them not enlightened enough, then the remedy is not to take away their powers, but to educate and inform their discretion. This gets us to the business of cultural transmission very quickly. Okay? Oh my gosh, it's working like a charm. This computer's set up. That's spectacular. Hey, can you get some cartoons? There are two books. One of them is the Cavalli-Sforza and Feldman book on cultural transmission and evolution, and the other one is Metamagical Themes. Both of these are fairly mathematical, and if you're bored over break, there's not only a book list on my website, but these, particularly the one on the right, would be a good one for you. So we'll start with a pop quiz, and we have about 5 more minutes, and then we'll have our extemporaneous writing. So what do these following items have in common? And you may have had this pop quiz before, maybe back at the first of the semester. All of them: Powerball, Super Bowl, talk radio, Amazon, understanding of the role disease plays in politics and war. And the answer is these are all entities that have the power. They're all constructs by and large, but they have the power to move through populations in a manner very similar to that of infectious agents. And I have a note to myself there to define the word meme, and going to be asked about a meme on your writing. Meme, M-E-M-E, is the same, is the cultural equivalent of a gene. It's an item that's made by humans, whether an idea or a thought or a tangible object, that moves through a population. The cell phone is a meme. The word like in your vocabulary is a meme. Like is a meme. Okay? So this movement of infective ideas through populations depends first on the growth of awareness, source, makers of these new products, and transmitters. So the vectors that transmit this stuff are your peers, radio, TVs, and so forth. And the infection then really is the result, or the infection culminates, I should say, in some kind of an action. You go buy a new cell phone because your friend has one. It's a lot of terminology to go with the movement of ideas through populations. And we'll talk about some of those very quickly. There's the thing of vertical transmission. God, I love this. That's exactly what... There's the thing, there's the direction of vertical transmission from generation to generation, you know, parent to offspring. There's a matter of horizontal transmission between peers. Come on, there we go. Horizontal transmission. Some items that are very familiar to you are culturally are transmitted vertically. So religious beliefs, voting patterns, wealth tends to flow. Attitudes go both ways. For you parents, you'll discover that pinworms, body lice, and intestinal protozoa tend to come up from your children through daycare. Horizontally transmitted infectious cultural agents include clothing styles, language, and old exams. I made this kind of wisecrack here because I'm not really, I've never been convinced. And if I'd thought about this 10 years ago, I'd have kind of a major earth-shattering publication on this subject. It's never been obvious to me that when I give students old exams, they're terribly useful. But when you give one another the same exam, somehow or another, that seems it's like it's important. I have no idea why. Here's a very simple phylogeny for those of you that are going home over the break. This is straight out of our material from the last weeks. Cultural items transmitted by way of descent include silver, jewelry, pottery, books, photographs, letters, stories, furniture, although you're going to modify some of that stuff by the time you get it. Infectious agents that are descended along with their hosts show what we call congruent phylogenies. Those that tend to cross lines of descent that are not congruent with host phylogeny are referred to as sort of host switching, host capture, and that might look like something like this. So that if that antique vase that your grandmother gave to your mother and your mother wants you to have ends up in your second cousin's hands, that's a case of this. The vase has captured your second cousin. Okay? What makes these things infective? What makes ideas go through populations? Well, the Hofstadter book talks about a system in which you make a series of statements and end up with, it's your duties to convince others that this set of statements is true. For example, and this is also straight out of Hofstadter, we might set up a system that says, if you don't believe in this system, you're going to burn in hell. And it's your duty to save others. We could say, anybody who doesn't go to Cedar Point, it's going to burn in hell. And it's your duty to get everybody there, okay, to save them from suffering. This whole idea of a self-replicating and viral or infective idea or statement is really at the heart of advertising and at the heart of... It's mathematically the equivalent of an epidemic. Okay? Those ideas behave mathematically just like germs. And here's a good one that I see all the time, people infected with. If I don't make a 4-point, I'm a big-time failure with no future whatsoever. there's another version of that that I think is probably even more dangerous, but also infective. That is that if I do make a 4-point, then everything else will fall into perfect place for the rest of my life. Don't bet on it. We may have said this before. Don't bet the farm. I think what I'll do at this moment is leave you with the take-home messages. Ideas can behave in a manner just like parasites. They can have infectivity and virulence and occur in epidemic forms. And they can also alter the socioeconomic situations, populations. Okay, here's your writing.